seminar. I'm very sorry that the other day, Sunday, I couldn't speak because my throat was hurting very much. We also do it in the afternoon, this Stay High Forever Kirtan, which is 2.5 hours of chanting. So after 3 days, my voice was not in good shape, so I had to discontinue this seminar. But we're continuing again today, and we want to start where we left off. So if you recall, we were talking about the problems associated with sense perception. Our thoughts are generally based, unless one is come to the stage of transcendental knowledge, receiving knowledge from one whose consciousness has surpassed sense perception. Generally, all of our thoughts are associated with sense perception. And that means mostly philosophy, human philosophy, is concerned ultimately with what we perceive. And there are big problems with sense perception. So therefore, thoughts or ideas, philosophy, which is trying to explain things on the basis of sense perception, that type of philosophy will also have big, big problems. And that type of philosophy we call material philosophy, materialistic philosophy. So we want to look at these problems of materialistic philosophy. So the first thing, referring to this book, Substance and Shadow, which I wrote, the first thing that we should note, and I think you all know this from reading Srila Prabhupada's book, is that the senses are imperfect. And so therefore, materialistic philosophy or material science, it turns out to be a hopeless struggle against imperfect senses. So I want to just now read about the imperfect senses. The first thing is that, I'll just read from here, the Vedic literatures explain that our minds receive impressions from the senses. These impressions signal the existence of a substance, or in Sanskrit, vastu, a substance which is external to us. Now, that substance is the cause of what we perceive. In truth, that substance is Krishna, the cause of all causes. However, unless we are fully Krishna conscious, we do not perceive him as the substance on the other side of sense perception. As Srila Prabhupada states in his purport to Bhagavad Gita 14.8, Vastu yatatmya jnana varakam viparya jnana janakam tamaha. Under the spell of ignorance, one cannot understand a thing as it is. Instead, we perceive only whatever impressions our materially conditioned senses are able to convey. Sound, touch, form, taste, and smell. We cannot know beyond these impressions what actually is out there. Hence, perception is occult, since its cause is ever hidden. Any knowledge that depends on the authority of pratyaksha is curtailed on all sides by our ignorance of the substance of reality. So perhaps I should try to explain this if it's not clear to you from what I read. What impressions mean, sense impressions, they're like signals. Signals from a vastu, a substance, which is out there before us. And actually, that which is out there is Krishna and his energies. But through our senses, we do not actually directly perceive that substance or that truth, because we are not in our conditioned state seeing the world around us as Krishna and his energy. What are we seeing? We are seeing only what our eyes allow us to see, or our ears allow us to hear, or our sense of touch allow us to feel, or our nose allows us to smell. So these are impressions. They're limited. As I said, they're just signals. But they are not the truth that is out there itself. So this is one very, very important point to understand, because as I point out in this first chapter of the book, material scientists, they like to believe that the world is accessible to our senses. But unfortunately, it is not. The actual world, the actual truth out there, we do not access with our senses. We access only a very limited signal of that truth. And this is, you can even understand this in terms of what is known in modern science. For example, the range of human sight, when you compare that to the range of the known spectrum of light, from infrared to ultraviolet, you may have seen, I've seen these, they show these depictions, the wave, the spectrum of light. And you say, you can see infrared, that's below our power to see. That's very, very big spectrum. And ultraviolet, that's above our power, that's also very, very big. And that color band, which we can see, is very narrow. So, light conveys to us form. So, if there's so much light that we cannot see, that our eyes do not register, that means also there's so many forms which we are not aware of. And this is even on the material plane. And the same with sound. And the same with all of our senses. So even materially we can understand how limited sense perception is. So this is, again, this term impressions is very important. Prabhupada uses this term. All we're actually perceiving are impressions. Not the thing itself, not the vastu, not the reality, not the substance, just impressions. So that's the first way in which our senses are imperfect. But then going further, not only is pratyaksha limited to impressions, but our senses grasp these impressions imperfectly. So it would be one thing if we could at least say, well, at least that narrow spectrum of perceptions, that is accurate. But it is not. You see? So Srila Baladev Vidyabhushan points out, and here's a list, this is very good to know, a list of the defects of our senses. We know that our senses are defective. Here's a list of these defects. So, one is that our senses are able to perceive only objects that are within their range. Just like there is the Ganga. How many know that the Ganga is over there? Raise your hands. You know? But can you see the Ganga from here? No. Because it is beyond the range. So there are some people who say seeing is believing. So by that philosophy, the Ganga now does not exist. Because they cannot see it. So this is one defect. Our senses are able to perceive only objects that are within their range. They cannot detect those which are far away or also very near. See, something that comes even too near to our eye, like a little insect, it can come so close that you cannot see it. An object too small or too great likewise cannot be perceived. An atom is too small, an object that is too great, like this earth, the whole earth, we cannot see the whole earth. And when the mind is distracted, we miss even those objects that are within the range of perception. Something may be right there in front of you, and you, it is perfectly available for you to see, but your mind is on something else, and you miss it. Everybody has that experience. You see, you may find yourself in your at your desk, if you have a desk somewhere, and you're looking for something, and you're thinking it's not here, and you're looking around, but you have failed to see it because your mind is distracted. You have some problem on your mind, and thus you're unable to control your senses to access that thing. So this is another defect. Sense objects also obscure one another, as when the sunshine covers the shining of the stars, or when milk and curd mix together. This is a good example. The stars. Here in Mayapur, generally the sky is very, very clear, like last night. So you look up in the heavens and you see so many, many beautiful stars, just like jewels on a piece of black velvet cloth. They're very beautiful. But now you cannot see. Those stars are there. They're there, but you can't see them. Why? Because the sky is filled with sunlight, and that is covered with the light of the stars. So this is another example of the defect of the senses. Then, there's some more defects from the Srimad Bhagavatam, that we perceive a candle flame as a steady light, but actually, moment by moment, that flame is coming into being, existing very briefly and then disappearing, and then another flame is coming into being, existing, disappearing. And if you look closely at a candle flame, you'll see there's so much activity within it. But generally we think flame is just one thing, one like an object. And actually Bhagavatam says everything is like that. Because everything is produced of the modes of nature, creation, maintenance and destruction, or Rajaguna, Sattvaguna and Tamaguna. And these modes are always turning. So everything, even a so-called solid object like this tree or this harmonium or my body or anything you see is just like a candle flame. It is constantly being created, existing momentarily, and then being destroyed in its parts, at the atomic level, all through it. But we don't see this. Another defect is that sometimes due to mirage, we perceive water where there is only dry land. I'm sure everybody has had that experience at some time. And we perceive an object reflected upon a moving surface as moving, when in fact it is not. Like the moon in the sky, if it's reflected on the Ganga, then you'll see the moon in the water as being broken up by waves. So that is another defect, a sense defect. And then Western philosophy likewise admits that sense perception is defective. Here are some examples. That the same object sometimes appeared different to the same person as when a green tree appears black at night. The same object sometimes appears different to different persons as when a green tree looks red to a person who is colorblind. And then they say that we derive the forms and other qualities of sense objects from the functions of our sense organs. But objects and organs are really just atoms arrayed in empty space. And finally, what we perceive cannot be what really is at the moment we perceive it, since it takes time for perception to occur. For example, you look at the sun. We can all see the sun up there. But according to science, it takes 8 minutes for the light from the sun to reach the earth. So when you look at the sun, this is according to Western science anyway, you're seeing the sun as it was 8 minutes ago, not now. So you can actually not see the sun as it is now. You never can see that. So these are all different imperfections of the senses. So, out of this problems with sense perception, there are two types of what Prabhupada called pratyakshavadis. Pratyakshavadi is a kind of philosopher. Vadi means philosopher. And pratyaksha means perception, of course. So there are two kinds of philosophers who try to base their understanding of life on sense perception. And one kind is called the empiricists. So the word empiricist comes from a Greek word, which just means experience. So they think knowledge is to be gotten through experience, the experience of the senses. This is what you can trust as knowledge. But they are opposed by another group of pratyakshavadis, who are also relying on sense perception, who say you cannot get any knowledge through the senses. And these are the skeptics. So, actually, it's not really so much that there are two eternally opposed camps, the empiricists and the skeptics. Rather, that one who's on the platform of sense perception, his mind will vacillate, will move back and forth between these two positions. He'll be at one moment sure by sense perception that something is real, and then later on by the same perception, he'll start to doubt whether there's any reality in what he's perceiving. But there have been actually philosophers who have taken one extreme or the other in history. I give the example of an ancient Greek philosopher named Cratylus. He was a contemporary of Socrates. And so he said that since everything is changing in this world at every moment, therefore, you really can't say anything about anything. So, someone would come. He was recognized. He was respected as a sage. And people would come and ask him questions. And his only answer would be, he would wiggle his finger like this. Meaning, what's the point of asking your question? Because time is passing. Time is passing. As you are speaking, time passed. All these thoughts that you had, they've passed away. That you have framed in your question, what you were asking about is already passed away. The person you were addressing when you asked the question, me, myself, I have passed away in that time. So there's no point in saying anything. So this is a position of radical skepticism, you see. But we have to understand that actually, this is not knowledge. This is this opposition between the skeptics and the empiricists is proving that there is no knowledge in sense perception. I gave an example in the book. Just like the empiricist will say that actually our perceptions are really objective. There's actually a reality there. What is that reality? It can be seen in the flow of nervous impulses in the nervous system. You know, the nerve endings in the eye are being stimulated. You can measure that stimulation. You can measure the flow of impulses to the brain. There is some internal chemical reaction, electromagnet, whatever it is in the brain. So there is something actually happening. And this is the proof that sense perception is real. It is objectively real. But then the skeptic can say, wait a minute, all of that is taking place in our mind. You're talking about the brain and the nervous system, but these are just impressions in our mind. When a doctor cuts open the skull and sees that lump of gray matter, what is that actually? It's just an impression in our mind. There is no way to prove that there is actually something out there in the material, you know, that there actually is a real material world, because all of this is just an impression in the mind. So, excuse me. So in this way, the empiricists and the skeptics, they just go round and round. It's like a dog chasing its tail. You see? In my preparation for this book, I read many books of philosophy, and I'm always seeing this, how they're just chasing their tail. And it's very arbitrary. It's very arbitrary. It's not like they have some very systematic way of saying what is objective out there and what is subjective in here. It's very arbitrary. And Einstein, I quote him, in this edition of the book, I quote him in the new preface. He actually admitted that. He says it's all arbitrary. He said, we have some impressions of this world, and we categorize them in some way in our mind, in a very arbitrary way. Arbitrary means as you like. There's no real system, but however you think, you categorize it. And then he said, then we try to come to some conclusions about these things, some truth. And how do we come? How do we arrive at this so-called truth? Einstein, he said himself, by free fantasy. It was just the term he used. It is by free fantasy. You're getting some impressions. You categorize it in some way. This is outside, this is inside. And then you try to arrive at some so-called truth, some philosophy, by your fantasy. And this is what philosophy is all about. One philosopher is thinking this way, some fantastic thoughts. Another one that way, some fantastic thoughts. And it's all going into books. But what does it really mean? So this is the problem of basing knowledge on sense perception.
This is called mental concoction?
Huh?
Mental concoction?
Yes. This is mental speculation. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada said, I've quoted, that the only thing that you can really know from sense perception, from pratyaksha, I quote him, is that you have to accept your senses are imperfect. So you, by speculation, cannot have perfect knowledge. That is the axiomatic truth. That's the only truth that you can get from this experience of sense perception, that it is all imperfect. And you're trying to understand it through mental speculation. And therefore you cannot have perfect knowledge. So if we accept this, then we save ourselves a lot of trouble. But unfortunately, the materialistic scientists and philosophers, they dog stubborn, Prabhupada used that term, they're dog. Prabhupada said, like a dog, if he sees, especially an Indian dog, because they're very hungry, you see it's skinny. So you're eating something, the dog will come, he'll come closer, and you can say, hut! He'll jump away, but then he'll come back. If you take a stone throw, he'll run away. But you're eating, he'll come back. Prabhupada said, dog stubborn, they're always coming back. So, because they're materialists, they cannot give up this process. They cannot give up their faith in their sense perception, nor can they give up their faith in mental speculation. And if you remember the earlier class, I said the sense perception is coming out of tamoguna. So that means they're attached to the mode of ignorance, and that's why they can't give it up. So, now we want to explain how this empiricism, this idea that you can get knowledge through the senses, is actually nothing more than a belief. I think this is very important for us as preachers to understand, because people are always putting forward such kind of arguments based on sense perception. How do we know that what you say is true? Because we cannot see this blue God that you talk of, this Krishna. We cannot see the soul that you say we really are. So how can we believe any of this? But actually, the fact is that empiricism, or thinking that sense perception is knowledge, is itself a belief. It's just a belief, and not a very good belief. So I will read here. If the claim of empiricism, that sense data is knowledge, was a truth, then the empiricist would be able to demonstrate objectively that there is nothing to be known beyond sense data. You understand? If it were true that sense data, what we're perceiving now, is knowledge, then it should be, the empiricist should be able to prove that there is nothing beyond sense data. There is only this, this is the only truth. But unfortunately, the very term empiricism, which comes from the Greek empiria, experience, means that sense experience is the limit of empirical knowledge. Confined by their method within this limit, empiricists have no means of knowing whether or not there is something beyond the experience of the senses. Therefore, their claim, sense data is knowledge, is nothing more than a belief. Just like a skeptic, he may say, this is what the skeptics say, that you can't know anything. But how do they know that that's true? That's a statement of knowledge. You can't know anything. But that's a statement of truth. We can't know the truth. That is a statement of truth. You see? So this is actually belief. He's just expressing his belief that we cannot know anything because the senses are imperfect. Or the empiricist will say that all knowledge is within the bubble of our sense perceptions and there is nothing to be known beyond. But how can he know that that's true? Because his senses cannot go beyond. You see? His senses cannot penetrate. You know, you cannot see beyond your power to see. Even you put a telescope in front of your eye, that also has its limit. And what's beyond that? You don't know. And if you just say, there's nothing beyond it, that's your belief. That's not knowledge. So all of this empiricism and also skepticism, it is a kind of religious belief. It is a faith. And that's all. So therefore, I go on to speak of what is called in modern philosophy reflexivity. Reflexivity means you're making a statement which comes back upon yourself. So the empiricists, these empirical scientists, they like to criticize the devotees or religious people that you are just bound up by your beliefs. You believe in God, but you cannot see this God. So you're just living in a world of beliefs. But this is reflexive criticism. It bounces back upon themselves. You see? For an empiricist, to argue that God and the soul exist only as subjective beliefs is reflexive. For the empiricist is sunk in his own subjective belief that sense data is knowledge. Just like I speak of one famous empiricist named A.J. Iyer, a British philosopher. And he's going on and on, talking about how foolish it is to believe in a God. Yet the problem is that his idea that seeing is believing, or to see is to know, to perceive is to know, that isn't in itself. So therefore, some scientists, like Karl Popper, he has admitted, at no stage are we able to prove that what we now know is true. He admits that. It is always possible that what we now know through sense perception will turn out to be false. And then he goes on to say, practically everything that has been known as so-called truth in the past is now considered to be false. And these scientists admit that probably everything we now say that is true, in the future, future scientists will say, oh, those were foolish old beliefs. They're no longer true. So his conclusion is, the only thing that science can do is prove that something is not true. It cannot prove what is true, but it can prove that something is not true. Now this doesn't make any sense. Because unless you know what is true, you cannot prove what is not true. But he's giving this as a definition of what is real science. He says, the only thing that you can call science is something that can be tested. You have to be able to investigate it and test it empirically, and gradually you'll find out the faults in it. It's, in other words, it's an enterprise of fault finding. You know, when you find out enough faults, then you can reject it. You can say, this is nonsense. And then something else will be put forward, this is true. And then they test it. Time will go by, and finally they'll find enough faults in this idea and reject it. No, it's not true. This is Karl Popper, famous. I think he won the Nobel Prize. This is his definition of science. Now the problem is, if this is how he defines science, then his own theory, this is called, what is it called here? Falsifiability. Yes. The theory of that science simply falsifies things. It doesn't verify anything. Doesn't prove anything is true, but it just falsifies it. But this theory of his is not scientific, because it cannot be tested, as he has said, things should be tested. You understand this point? This is his doctrine, his dogma. He is speaking it as if from the transcendental platform. This is what science is, it only falsifies. But you cannot test this. by the scientific process. So he's giving, like, you see, a scriptural truth, so to speak, manufactured in his own brain. I'm telling you what science is. And you find this is all what these rascals... Therefore, Prabhupada called them rascals. Because by their pontificating, you know, they're pretending that they're on some high transcendental platform and they will tell you, oh, you foolish people, what truth is and what falsehood is and so on and so forth. But when you take their processes that they give and apply that to what they say, you find it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Their theories cannot test themselves. So this is called the problem of
reflectivity.
Reflect. That's one thing. Self-reference. Yes. Uh-huh. Self-reference. Just like I give the whole of modern philosophy begins about 500 years ago with Descartes, who said "De omnibus est dubitantum" in Latin, which means doubt is everything. Knowledge has to be, real knowledge is based on doubt. Doubt is everything. But there's a big problem in this statement. Because as soon as you accept that doubt is everything, then there's no more doubt. So how can there be any knowledge? You understand? So as soon as you accept that doubt is everything, then there's no more doubt. You just said what everything really is. But then again, because you say doubt is everything, then you're going to doubt that anyway. And if it's true, it's false. But if it's false, it's true. And you end up just going around in a circle. And that's all of materialistic philosophy is like that. Just going, it's like a dog chasing its tail around in a circle. So this defect is there. So yes, then I say how these empiricists, they do have a theory of truth called the correspondence theory of truth. That words, the words you speak should as much as possible match up to the perceptions we have of this world. So this is real science, in other words. We shouldn't say anything that does not correspond to sense perception. Anything outside, anything you say that's outside of sense perception, then that is false. That is illusion. So immediately we're faced with a big problem. You see, I'm still suffering a little bit from a sore throat. I feel a pain in my throat. But I can't show you this pain. See, this is not this is not subject to scientific examination, pain. So there was an actual scientist named Hempel who said, therefore pain is not real. Because you cannot take it and put it under a microscope and look at it. So pain is all illusion. But this is so far from reality. This is some madhouse philosophy. This is craziness. Pain is not real. But whenever we feel a pain, we are impelled by that pain to do something. Human life, human civilization, we're all so much concerned with pain. Therefore, we have hospitals. Therefore, you know, we have so many treatments. We have anesthetic. As soon as we feel a pain, we feel something's wrong. I have to do something. And here's this man, big scientist, saying, pain is not real. It's not real. It's just an illusion. Why? Because you can't see it. This is nonsense. Another problem with this correspondence theory of truth is that actually science does not correspond to what we see. The scientists like to say that. They like to tell that to you. But it's not true. I give the example of Einstein. He's the number one scientist. Number one scientist in the 20th century is Albert Einstein. You say Albert Einstein, all the materialistic people are making pranams. I even once met an Indian man many years ago in America. He used to come and visit the temple, see the devotees. But he was always wearing a green dhoti. Green dhoti. And I was thinking, it's very odd, you know. I've only seen from Hindu culture either saffron dhoti or white dhoti. So I asked him, why do you wear green dhoti? That green is Einstein's favorite color. For him, I wear green tooth. So Einstein, number one scientist, and so he has this theory of relativity. And all scientists accept this theory. But relativity is not something you can see. Relativity is saying, the basic theory of relativity is that everything is moving in relation. Okay. That science, that truth, you know, your words must correspond to perception. It is not true. Relativity does not correspond to perception. And also I explain how this theory of relativity was so-called proved. This is a big farce, a big scandal. It wasn't proved at all. It was just accepted. They had, actually, what happened was that they had the First World War. Before the First World War, everyone was believing in Newtonian science, which is this idea that there are things that are fixed and immovable, and through this fixed space, atoms, objects are moving like balls moving across a table. But Einstein is saying the table is also moving, and therefore the balls are moving. Everything is moving. So the First World War, it turned Western society upside down. So, you know, so many systems of government, belief in religion, all the old beliefs, they were swept away. Just like in Russia as a result of First World War, there was a Bolshevik revolution that turned that whole country upside down. Other countries similarly were so much. So people, they didn't know what to believe anymore. In 1918, everyone was wondering, what does life mean? What is the truth? Because it's such a horrible war. And so then it was at that time that Einstein's theory became popular, because it was a completely new, very radical, very different explanation of things. So they thought, oh yes, that's interesting, we'll accept it. But it was never proved. Although there was some so-called proof, but I explained in this book. It wasn't proof. So it's like, you know, it's like a fashion. Scientific ideas and philosophical ideas are coming and going just like women's clothes, you know, fashions, you know. They're just a spring fashion, summer fashion. They're changing. So it's the same way with these materialistic intellectual ideas. There's no more rhyme and reason to why they change, just the changing of the modes of nature. Then sometimes they say, well, you have to be very careful how you define words. Define words ostensibly. So ostensive definition means definition by scientists. They will define the words for us, because they are the men of knowledge. So I give the example from this book. There's an Indian saying that one thing is seen three different ways. So the one thing is a woman. So a lusty man, a playboy, sees a woman in one way as an object of his pleasure. And ascetic, a man who has sense control, he sees a woman as just a form of matter. And a dog, there's a kind of dog which you see congregates around burning grounds in India. So they eat dead bodies. So this dog will see a woman as a meal. Maybe still moving, so I can't yet eat. But when it stops moving, then I will go and feast. That's how. So scientists, they say, we have to scientifically define. We put a woman up in front of a group of scientists, and we point to her, and a scientist will say, woman. And everyone will write it down. Yes. But still, even defined in that way, you can still see women in different ways, or anything, according to your mentality. So therefore this correspondence theory of truth, it breaks down. It really doesn't make any sense in the end. So these are the problems of basing knowledge on perception. Therefore one big science, big philosopher named Wittgenstein, he said, all we're doing in human society is playing games with language. We're using words in different ways according to how we think they should be applied. It's just all on the mental platform. It's not really that our words are actually given definition by the things out there, but they're given definition by our own minds. And this is actually ultimately, in this world of mental speculation, what is happening. So, therefore, the claims of the scientists, their claims to have knowledge, their claims that knowledge is established sense perception. These claims are not real. They're not actually what is practiced in the world out there by people. Actually, what is going on is just what Prabhupada says. Everything is going on under mental speculation. That's all. So, I would like to stop here. We have a few minutes left. We're going to end. This is the end of our discussion on the problems of perception. Tomorrow we will go on and talk about anuman, or reason, thinking, which is the second prama. So if we have any questions now, yes? No, well, yes, her question is that if we reject everything the scientists say, then what was it about scientific achievements? Yes. Why does Srila Prabhupada still use some examples taken from science or scientific achievements to explain things? Well, the thing is that Prabhupada did not reject the scientific achievements themselves, because science and technology science and technology, these are skills, shudra skills, just like the word technology, it's traced back to a Sanskrit word through Greek, takshati, which is a skill of a carpenter. Yeah, carpenters, just like they make in Vedic culture, Rati Yatra. That is a kind of yantra, a machine. So that is a skill, and we use it. We use such things in Krishna's service. Either a wooden rat cart for the deities, or you can use a car, or you can use an airplane. These are all vehicles built by technology. That's fine. But this is on the Shudra level of knowledge. So in the Kali Yuga, the Shudras want to assume the position of the Brahmanas. And that's what is rejected. When the Shudras are trying to explain the origin of the world and the purpose of human life in terms of technology, then we reject that. You understand? Oh, yes. I was careful to say that's what the scientists say. But this is a proof in terms of Western knowledge of the imperfection of the senses. The senses, they themselves admit that the senses are limited. And this is one example that they give. That they have somehow calculated that it takes 8 minutes for light to reach our eyes. But also, you know, that sound travels, taking time. Everybody knows that. Someone far away, if they shout to you, you will see them shout, and then after a moment, you will hear what they have shouted. That is because the sound takes time. So, this is another example of the limitation of the senses. Okay?
He says that still suppose in 10 years, they say that actually it takes 12 minutes. That was a mistake.
Yeah. Well, that's not really so important, I think. The fact is that they're just admitting that this is a limitation, in the sense of whether 8 minutes or 12 minutes or whatever. That's not vital to the point.
I have one question. In Srimad Bhagavatam, there are so many statements which are very difficult to understand. One can only understand when one is very pure in consciousness. For instance, there is said that, that the demigods, they enter in the different facilities in the third canto, the different facilities of perception. Like the moon god enters in this process of speculation, mental speculation, that it is possible. There's a moon god inside. So I don't quite understand. Maybe it's possible. I don't know if it's possible at all to explain these things to people who are not really on this level to have adhika to these higher understandings of things. Because we are usually on this material level. We think, what is a demigod having to do with all these things? It is more like some signals and this and that, you know?
Well, of course, that will depend on the receptivity of the person you're talking to. What I found, one very good way to get across, to get people to at least be open to this very explanation of what you're talking about, that ultimately everything is personal,
right.
That our eyesight depends on persons, demigods, hearing, all of our senses. So one way to get Western people who are very impersonal to open up is to explain that formerly, in ancient times, Chinese, the Taoists of ancient China, all around the world, they shared the same basic understanding of what this world is in terms of personality. But this world is actually a manifestation of various demigods, and mostly they believe that there was a personal source to all these demigods. They weren't very sure, perhaps, exactly what that personal source was, but ultimately they did accept a kind of oneness of the whole thing. And this is very interesting. Some modern philosophers have written a book too, I forget their names, but they wrote a book and they were surveying. We were doing a survey of all the ancient cultures around the world and how similar their understanding of this very point and also the shape of the universe, the sun and the planets. It's all corresponds to our Bhagavatam description in Polynesia, in ancient Scandinavia, ancient Greece, all these cultures. And they said it's remarkable how similar their science, put it this way, their science was at that time. And they say according to how we view those cultures now, we think that they could not have been in communication with each other. You know, we think that travel between these cultures was very, very limited. So if that's true, then how is it on this side of the world and the opposite side of the world, they were looking at the universe and looking at our physiology, our sense perception, everything in the same basic way. So they're proposing that this must have been a science of the ancient world, just like now. Just like now, you can go to New York, Los Angeles, Tokyo, Moscow, any big city in the world, and you can talk with the scientists and you'll find that they're all sharing the same basic view of the world. So this is a very strong point. If 2,000, 3,000 years ago, the civilizations were similarly sharing the same basic but personal outlook of the world, and the same idea of the earth as being like Bhumandala and the sun moving around the earth, and demigods and all of this in all the different corners of the world, then we are forced to conclude that must have been a science. And just as they also say, just as you may have some scientific writings, but without a scientist there to explain it to you, it's very difficult to understand. So these old stories, Vedas, Puranas, and from other cultures, they're very difficult for us to understand. We take them as mythology because we don't have a scientist from those times to explain them to us. Of course, we do. Now, Srila Prabhupada, is explain the Vedic science, to us. So I found that this is a very effective way to get this across to people.
Thank you.
Yes?
You were just making the point, many scientists are admitting that our sense perception is limited, like for example with the sun. In my understanding, some scientists even say that that reality must be fundamentally different from what we perceive. Somebody like Werner Heisenberg,
yes,
in the beginning of the century, he made that specific remark. My question is, have you, in your investigation of books of scientists and philosophers, do you also see a tendency of scientists to go more to a spiritual explanation?
So he's saying that there are scientists who say that what we perceive and what actually is are fundamentally different. And so then he's asking, are scientists in their thinking of reality beyond our perceptions, are they moving in a more spiritual direction? So my answer to that is that the trend that I have seen is that they're moving in a Mayavadi direction. There are some books that have come out with titles like The Dancing Wu-Li Masters and other such books. And they come to a conclusion of impersonal Brahman. So, yes, at least they're negating the sense perception. At least they're saying the sense perception is not real. But then beyond it, it's this process of negation, as Prabhupada says. By negation, then they conclude that the truth cannot have any of the qualities of what we perceive. If what we perceive has form, then the truth can have no form. If it has variety activity, then the truth can have no variety activity like that. So this means they're still in ignorance. This means they're still relying on their mind and senses, just in reverse.
You think they're more open to to real understanding?
He's asking, are they more open to real understanding? If they're attached to impersonalism, that makes it very difficult for them to be open to Krishna consciousness. And this is a problem. But by good preaching, by good presentation, they can realize the fallacy of the impersonal position. I mean, Prabhupada once said, even our... because typically it is said that women are not so inclined to philosophy. But Prabhupada said, our Matajis in this movement, they can defeat the most erudite philosopher and scientist with a few simple points of Krishna conscious philosophy. Yes?
You talk about the planet and all the Earth, and I wanted to ask, is the planet now, is this Earth a planet, or is it flat, or how is it?
He's asking if the Earth is a round planet or a flat plane. Well, I think the best investigation of those questions was done by Satyaputra Prabhu in his book called Vedic Cosmology. I suggest that you read that. He's given evidence to show that both are true simultaneously. And if you find that hard to believe, well, you know, scientists, they say that matter is simultaneously both a wave and particles. So they can accommodate that. So I think we can also accommodate that the Earth is both round and flat. It's, why not? But you should read that book, because he's given very much detailed information. Okay, we're now over time. All right, I'll take your question last.
You have said that perceived truth is by some. So, as a nearby devotee, sometimes mostly prophets said that Ganga is pure and Kali is pure. As a nearby devotee, it's hard to accept those things. Mm. Now, there is a scientific process that being done by the scientists that they found out that cow dung is pure and database, if you want. It seems that this fracture system has a little bit helped our philosophy.
All right. So he's making the point that Prabhupada said, Ganga is pure, cow dung is pure. And that's difficult for us to accept as neophytes, but it can be helpful when we hear that some scientific studies have actually shown that cow dung is pure and Ganga is pure. So there is therefore some use for pratyaksha. Yes, that's true. I don't mean by these remarks to negate pratyaksha as being totally useless. I explained this in the beginning. But the pratyaksha is subordinate to the shabda. You cannot put forward arguments based on pratyaksha that challenge shabda. And this is the problem with the pratyaksha process, is because you're dealing with matter which is always changing, and you're dealing with minds that are always changing, and the influence of the modes of nature, and our people have their biases. You know, there's some scientists who are actually inclined. They're inclined, like Indian scientists are inclined, to prove the Vedas through their scientific research. Like that Professor Bose, Prabhupada used to speak of. He was showing that even plants have life, they have feeling, they respond to pleasure and pain. So, and he was, in his explanation, he was saying, thus this verifies the statements of the Upanishads, that there is souls in everything. So Indian scientists, they have that inclination. Now, some demoniac scientists, Western demoniac scientists, he may have the opposite inclination, and he may marshal evidence to prove the opposite. Just like I remember you're talking about how it's been shown that cow dung and Ganga is pure, but I remember a few years ago, reading in some newspaper about a scientific study that claimed to prove that drinking milk is very bad. So that means they will have their, you know, charts, and they will say, we studied so many people for so many years, and we have found that drinking milk is very bad. But this does not correspond with the Vedic statement, so therefore we reject it. Now someone else may come and show that drinking milk is good, but you see what I mean. On the platform of pratyaksha, actually there is no way to decide who's right and who's wrong. Okay. You have to measure these things against the statement of shastra. That is the actual system of values. So pratyaksha that matches the shabda, we'll accept, that's nice. And that which is against shabda, we reject. And that's the only standard. And ultimately the scientists themselves, they do the same. Only with them, it is their own authorities. Like I said, Einstein, big authority. So whatever he says, we'll accept. You can't prove it. Relativity hasn't actually been proven by any, you know, system of pratyaksha. Because Einstein himself said, you cannot prove it. He was asked, when there was some so-called proof of his relativity theory that came in, he was even asked that, what would you have said if this experiment disproved relativity? He said it wouldn't matter to me, because I know that. So he's big scientist, he says it is true, and so many little scientists, they say, Einstein has said it is true. So this is shabda. This is shabda. Of course, it is not Vedic shabda, but it is the same. And that's really how the world of science goes on. That's really how it goes on. It's just the big guys at the top. They're the ones who are telling all the little fellows what to believe, what not to believe. And your experiments have to correspond with our theories. And if they don't, then you reject it. And there are many cases. I read a book in preparing for this one called Forbidden Science. And it's full of stories of scientific experiments which went against the theories and how they were kicked out. There was one man in the early 50s, Bielakowski. So he was making many claims, and one of his claims is that Venus, the planet Venus, must be a desert, must be a horrible desert. But at that time, the scientists, because they were seeing Venus covered with clouds, they're thinking, no, somewhere speculating it must be covered with an ocean, there must be or there it must be very green, like a jungle, much water, because there's so much clouds, there must be always rainfall. And that was the accepted idea, the establishment idea of science. So when Bielakowski in 1950 or 51 was saying Venus must be a desert, they were saying this guy is crazy. And they rejected him. They did a whole political thing. The Macmillan Company was publishing Bielakowski's book, and the scientists, they put pressure on the Macmillan Company. Don't, if you publish his book, then we will withdraw all our books from your publishing house. You'll lose our business. So therefore, the Macmillan Company very humbly said, all right, you give it to another publisher. They put so much pressure. And the interesting thing is that now, in 1997, it is accepted that Venus is a desert. And this is the way science goes. All right, so we have to stop. It's 7 minutes after 12. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Please come again tomorrow at 11 o'clock, right here. We will continue with the subject of Hanuman.